Just kidding. Contrary to popular wishes, we have not all been super glued to our seats and subjected to Vulgon poetry. This is episode 6 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Andrew Gregory.
And in this podcast, we're going to be talking about GTK 3 finally coming forward, Windows shipping apparently on 96% of all netbooks, Spotify's new API for Linux, and should netbook makers use a single distro? Don't forget, we're releasing a new podcast every 2 weeks, available for free from tuxradio.com, where we also publish fantastic news, features, and more, so bookmark it today. And actually, this podcast, right now, there's a new issue of Linux Format Magazine on sale. It's great, particularly good. You can find out how to get the best distro for you. You can read about Subversion, Grease Monkey, Clonezilla, the Acer Aspire 1, Moblin, and much more. Because if you like Tux Radar, you'll love Linux Format. And yes, before you say otherwise, it is indeed on sale worldwide. If you want to subscribe, go to tinyurl.com/podcastlxf. So the top news this week is, of course, GTK 3.0. There are now the first draft plans, I think, out to the mailing list.
Yeah, it's like a preliminary roadmap at this stage. They're a request for comments. It's basically the stage it's in. And
first impressions?
Well, they've outlined various features that they want to put in, like resolution independence, which would be great. But what strikes me from the plan is that there are a lot of cool features in there that they're waiting for other developers to implement, or they hope that other developers will implement. Things like animations and physics. It seems more of a wishful thinking list rather than an all-out plan.
Did you see their first plans, though? Because they talked about it at GWIDEC last year, last July or something it was. And the first plan was remove all the public fields, add no new features, and just release it like that, and then add features in subsequent releases.
Really?
Basically so that 3.0 would be like KDE 4.0, a sort of binary compatibility layer. And after that, they just add things. So obviously, a lot of folks, including people like Miguel de Cars, were very upset about that because it's a silly idea.
Well, so, I guess you can get away with that more as a toolkit because it's not something that end users really worry about. When KDE went to 4.0 with loads of features missing, Everybody was up in arms, but I guess they'd say, well, don't use GTK for any proper apps until GTK 3.2 or something when we've plugged in the guards.
Yeah, but this is what a lot of guys said about 4.0 for KDE. I understand what you're saying about it's a finished product, but a major version release in people's brains that says this is a finished product, start using it, great new features. You can't just say, hey, there's nothing new, wait for 3.2, 3.4. Just call it 2.9.9 if you want to do some beta testing, fair enough. Add features.
That's true. That's the normal way to go about it, isn't it?
Yeah, I had kind of presumed that GTK would always stay in the 2 revision and never kind of make
forever.
It
forever.
Yeah, I mean,
like Emacs.
They seem like to be the doing kernel.
Fine. I mean, one of the things was a palette widget. Which they meant to get into the 2 revision, which they've now pushed back to 3. So why not just stick it in now? You know, they could do the same with Cairo and resolution independence if they wanted to, because the applications are going to have to be ported to take advantage of it.
It's true, but the wish list, I thought, was where the best things were. They want to, for example, do some really cool non-breaking changes that wouldn't break API, wouldn't break programs built on GTK. One of them is to basically bin the entire theming system and replace it with something like Qt's CSS system, which is very cool and everyone seems to be liking. And it looks really good and it's much easier and all these great things.
But that wouldn't change the API, would it? Because that's all
it wouldn't,
something
yeah, just,
you store
just work.
In config files.
But of course, as like you said, you've got the things they're going to do themselves, then the sort of hopefully some somewhere else contribution community list, and this is in the wish list, the sort of third layer down, so I'm not sure how likely it is to actually happen. But yeah, they've got some great ideas. They want to add multi-touch, for example.
Yeah, that was almost a footnote as well, wasn't it, in the list of features, which is something perhaps we should be putting higher up on the priority list.
Yeah, we don't want to always get sued by Apple, do we?
No, but it's a bit scary because multi-touch is something that's so core to these toolkits nowadays. Needs to be core.
Yeah.
If they didn't do it in 3.0, you're talking 4.0, aren't you? And that's a long, long
way
away.
27 years away.
Do you reckon? It's a conservative estimate.
Yeah. So I think they had to get that in 3.0 as a matter of priority. Same as like animation. If they don't do it now, it will not happen for a long time. Or if it will happen, it won't be backported. You know, no one will be using it because you can't be guaranteed it's there. Also, I think there's a throbber too.
That's one of the things they want other people to implement. That's one of the things they're hoping that the community will fill in, a spinning, loading thing. That's what a throbber is.
The old Netscape Navigator little comets thing, or the N sign, or the...
And this is a big, significant feature.
Yeah,
that
it is, yeah, it is.
Something to get excited about.
It is. Well, I know it sounds strange, but if you think about how common they are on things like Ajax websites, when you do something, it's thinking about it. It shows a little spinny thing. There isn't something like that right now. You get a little spinning white cursor, don't you? Which
is lame. It's not really something any of us with a modicum of programming knowledge could implement. Why is that on a...
And there, Mike Saunders signs up to the community contribution to do the throbber.
Good work, Mike. Leave now.
And moving on, Microsoft has claimed that Windows ships on 96% of all netbooks. We actually put up a new story about that, didn't we?
Yeah. Well, we should clarify that Microsoft has given these statistics for US markets, and Linux uptake is obviously bigger in other countries as well, especially Germany and developing countries. So, but even then, 96%. It seems remarkably high. When you see people using netbooks, Graham, do you see people 96% of them running Windows?
No, I mean, I think I wrote something similar in the last issue of the magazine. But it's a very optimistic figure. But it's one that Microsoft. It's one of Microsoft's tactics, isn't it? It's the kind of shock and awe effect of we monopolize everything, we're brilliant, we're doing everything we can, and it makes people talk about Microsoft and do exactly what we're doing now. I'm sure it's not 96%.
But given that the trouble they've had in the past for being a monopoly, you think it would do them better to say we've got 90% of netbooks, but by saying, look, we completely slaughter and dominate another market and not allow anybody else to get into it, then they might end up in front of the European Commission again.
Was it mentioned on a blog? Was that what it was?
It was on the Microsoft Windows Team experience or some combination.
That's the interesting thing. It wasn't just some higher PR release. It was just some guy saying, hey, this is what we've heard from our hardware manufacturers.
But it had been peppered with all this, the usual PR stuff. So he gave the stats, and then he was saying, why do people choose Windows then? It's because you don't have to use the command line. And other remarks that are perhaps not applicable so much to Linux today.
Well, I think we've talked about this in the past, haven't we? How a lot of people will be dissuaded from buying Linux on netbooks because at the point of sale, the company selling it can make more money from Windows netbooks or have fewer returns, whatever they're saying.
You sell somebody a Windows netbook and you can sell them Norton anti-internet.
Microsoft's almost giving it away. You don't have to worry about codecs. You don't have to worry about anything like that. It's a familiar operating system. They've done a good job at clawing back, their traditional market share after initial Linux inroads into it. So.
Well, yeah, with the amount of money they've got, if they're operating like a traditional company, I think they'd have to fight this battle harder, but they can just give XP away for the next 200 years if need be.
What sort of Vista user experience do you think you get on an Aspire 1?
Even hardcore Windows fans really hate Vista on netbooks. A lot of them hate Vista anyway, so there's a lot of anticipation that Windows 7 will fix all these problems and be really super fast and light on netbooks. And of course, netbook specs will go up as well when a 2 GHz Atom comes out.
It's out.
It's out now, is it? Mm. Wow.
I find it very curious, though, because Keir Thomas, the author and pundit, said it's legally questionable to supply proprietary components pre-installed on Linux netbooks, because I think that's what's really missing. And this is something that Chris Kenyon from Canonical said. They said actually they recommend people to pre-install Flash and media codecs and actually recommend to OEMs to purchase from Microsoft the Windows Media Codecs. That's Ubuntu recommending to pay Microsoft money, which is very curious, I think, just to get a better netbook experience. So people obviously do want the basics to work out of the box. And I guess the companies who are shipping Linux stuff don't want to pay the extra $2 approximately it costs.
It probably starts costing them more than it would to just stick XP on there.
Yeah, if you get an XP for $5, then or you're buying these codecs from Fluendo and Microsoft.
Moving on. Mono 2.4 has been released along with Mono Develop 2.0. Do any of you care?
Mono 2.4 is faster.
Is it?
It is.
How?
Yeah.
Go.
Because some like JIT engine has been replaced with another JIT engine.
I'm not sure that's true.
I heard. That's what I read anyway.
They've removed an old JIT engine
that
wasn't being used anyway.
But what if you were using that one by accident?
What if you dash use old JIT engine?
Yeah. Yes. I always put that thing in. Yeah. I always put that command in.
It is slightly less memory intensive for some particular small tasks.
Right.
Very particularly, and this is because I'm a mono freak. XPath using XML is 15% less memory intensive.
Awesome.
Wow.
So all those XPath programs that you're writing.
That is pretty much the headline feature.
There was something about polling as well.
There is some cross-platform thread interruption.
Yeah.
Blah, 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 blah. It was really, really dull release. But it makes sense because of SUSE Linux Enterprise 11, which ships as standard. It's a mono extension.
Mono.
You pay extra for mono, apparently, nowadays.
Well, you buy SUSE Linux Enterprise, but you buy the mono.
Well, no, because they're saying with this release, with this 2.4 release, there are so few new features because it's basically rock solid. That's the idea.
Okay.
So in this release, you pay for mono, and they will support you in getting your Windows programs to work on Linux. That's the promise they're making. It's actually quite a cool promise. But more importantly, Mono Develop 2.0 has come out,
mm-hmm.
and that is cool. What's that got? It's got bloody exciting stuff.
Wow.
If you actually care. Firstly, it's got debugging. You can actually set breakpoints. Oh my god, I've had that in years. Every other OS language in the whole world.
How did you write programs before that?
You used to do console.writeline. I is this. it was really terrible. It supports C# 3 for code completion, which is random but helpful. Curiously, it switches to the Visual Studio project format from Microsoft.
MS Build.
It is indeed MS Build. I'm surprised. Yeah, MS Build. Yeah. it's impressive, Mike. Well done. So you actually take your whole MS project and load it on Windows. It basically saves that natively now, so you can move it around freely, which I think is very, very interesting move. They had their own project format for quite a while, I guess, so they could not look too MS aligned, and now they sort of actually sod it. They just have their stuff too. Yeah, whatever works for them. It's got cold folding. It's got change markers. You can now target particular .NET versions. It's got loads of stuff. It's actually a very, very exciting release.
Now we just need to convince the Linux community that C# is actually pretty good.
Yeah, I love C#. Mm. There you go. I come out absolutely clear. I think C# is the finest coding language known to man.
Address all hate mail and bombs to
Graham.Morrison. FutureNet. No, it's true. I mean, I've got to admit, I'm not happy that it's Microsoft technology. I wish... It weren't. I wish it was. Everyone was happy to use it.
But it was Microsoft originated. I know. But now it's under
the hands. Problem is, if I write something in C#, write any program, I get haters saying, "Hey, you shouldn't use that. You should use Python." No, Python's pants. Python is terrible in comparison. Python is not as good as C#.
Well, I like Python too, but I've done a bit of C# programming, and I do like the language, and that's what should matter at the end of the day. We shouldn't be running around screaming and bawling and having tantrums.
But when the Riders of the Apocalypse come and Microsoft exercises its patents on C# and .NET.
C#'s an ISO standardized language.
Well, okay, what about the .NET framework?
That large,
will all your
large
programs
chunks of that
then become immediately redundant?
Large chunks of that are ISO standardized as well. Not all of it is. Some large chunks of it is, though. The bits I use all are.
Right.
And what I care about is I say, okay, load me SDL, fiddle with SDL, fiddle with OpenGL.
Yeah.
I'm using the language to interface with all the native stuff. That's what I care about, native technology.
Is there any mechanism in place to ensure that you do keep to open technology within...
Maybe there should be. Mono. No, I'm not aware of one, no. Maybe there should be, yeah. So I'd much rather use Mono. What did I do? I was testing this game recently, G-Brainy.
Yeah, I think I've heard
a brain training game, right? Brain training game, very simple. It's built on Mono. I hadn't realised. It looked just like every other GTK app out there. Looked and worked. It was built on Cairo with GTK.
Right.
It looked and worked flawless, loaded quickly, and yet it was Mono. You can't do that in Java, as far as I'm aware.
You do it in Python, though.
You can do it in Python, yeah. But Python is a hideous programming language. I get sick of typing bloody underscore underscore init underscore underscore colon. All this kind of crap. And why is there no switch case? Why is there no switch case? Damn you, Guido Van Rossum.
I think we're going to need to get Guido in here, aren't we, somehow?
All right, we need to bring this one back in. Mono 2.4 has been released.
Great.
And with that, the news ends.
Right, this week's Hot Topic follows the release of a Spotify library, a binary library for Linux, potentially enabling Linux users to listen to their Spotify music if they have a premium subscription to the service. Spotify is, at the moment, a Windows and OS X application that looks very much like iTunes, except for you can listen to the music immediately. You don't have to buy anything. It's financed presumably by the adverts that are interspersed into the music every 20 minutes, half an hour, 45 minutes or so, as well as banner ads that scroll in and out of the main application window. It's quite addictive because you end up listening to music you wouldn't normally pay for or want to go out of your way to listen to. But
So the idea is that you've got a huge music library.
Yeah.
It's gigantic. I've found really random old artists on there, full album to listen to, just double click, it'll start playing the entire thing. You can go through everything you want free of charge.
And those who've never used it before will probably be asking, how do they make any money off this?
Yeah, well, nobody really knows if they are making any money off it.
Secret.
It was Andrew's discovery of the week a couple of episodes ago.
Yes. You're ahead of the curve.
And now it's exploded in popularity.
For a change. And at that time, it was because you managed to get it to work on wine.
So does this mean that you won't have to use wine anymore?
It means that people who pay for a premium account in the UK, it's £9.99 a month. You don't get the adverts.
Is that about, what, $12 right now? $13?
Yeah, probably about.
I think $14 right
$7.
Now.
$5.
$50.
$50. Yeah, so if you have a premium account and you've got the programming skill, you can create an application natively on your Linux desktop and listen to Spotify music, yes.
But it's closed source.
It's closed source.
So you can't share it with anyone?
You can create applications, you can share them with people, yes, because you just link to the library. If you're interested in doing it, you have to apply for an application key, which you embed within your application, and then you're free to share it, and presumably Spotify keep a log of how their music is being accessed. But the key point here is that you have to have a premium account, and I don't know, but presumably by and large most people don't have a premium account. And with this library, it gives you the potential of skipping the adverts. Or,
well, still, the library only works with premium users.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I'm saying it's always going to be the case. I don't see it ever coming to a, it's never going to mature into a Spotify application, a general Spotify application for the Linux desktop, because you'll be able to skip adverts.
How?
Well, you could silence the volume when you detect the advert. You could do all kinds of things. You could work out the track length. If the track length is exceeded, you could silence that. You could buffer it, drop it out of the buffer. There's all kinds of things you could do.
You could certainly try and hack it, but the way I see it is that if right now on the OS X version, if you try and reduce the volume, it detects that.
Yeah, but if you're responsible for, you grab the audio data through the library,
and then
you stick that in your own buffer, you know, you can detect whether you've got an advert in there, chop it out.
Yeah, you could try. Yeah.
So, I'm guessing that's why it's for premium users only.
Yeah, well, that makes sense for a start, doesn't it? So they can track it more easily, who's using it and why they're using it.
And they don't have to worry about people cutting the adverts out, because they've already paid for that premium account. So it's a step in the right direction. I mean,
I don't think people cut adverts out because on the general Linux desktop, if that happened, Spotify would just turn it off. They haven't got the resources to fund free music for the world. They would just disable the free account, and then they would have sunk it for everyone very publicly.
Yeah, but they've obviously not got the resources to write a Linux application, which seems like they see the demand for as well. And this is kind of throwing something out to the community, hoping that they'll pick it up and stick it into Amarok or Rhythmbox.
Yeah, I'm guessing actually this is something they've had all along. They must have had this to begin with.
Yeah.
To build their own stuff with.
It can't be that difficult to do. I mean, no. if you look at the API, it's pretty straightforward. You know, you can get artist information, you can get associated artists, cover data, and the audio stream.
Also, there's lots of example source code. Do you have a look at that?
Yeah, yeah. The example source code looks really straightforward. Written in C.
It is really easy to use.
You could use that today if you had a premium account, compile that, listen to music on the command line.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the examples is, I think, a command line jukebox of playing your playlists.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just basic and exactly what people want to do most of the time, really.
And it really would be amazing if it let people without a premium account to use Spotify in this way. I mean, it opens up so much potential.
Yeah.
And it's a pity that I can't see a way around that happening or being able to happen.
Yeah, I guess they could just not provide the track length for adverts.
Yeah.
Or something like that, or for all of them. Yeah. Just, whatever it takes to make it work, I'm happy.
Yes, I think I am as well, yeah.
You know, given that most people out there, I presume, are not users of the premium account, they're just the free one with adverts, and they seem quite happy to listen to the adverts, because adverts aren't that intrusive, and they're pretty rare, quite frankly. I don't think it's a problem. I think people are happy to
do
whatever
agree.
It takes to get free music.
Yeah.
Also, Roberta from Spotify has got a really nice voice.
She's just one of the adverts. Once an hour or so, yeah, one of the adverts. And
I am one of only two people in Britain to never use Spotify, and the other one is me as well, due to an administrative error.
But that's, you don't have an internet connection, do you?
No.
So a person from the other side of the street flashes data to you with a spotlight, and you write down the bits and type it into macOS. That was a Freudian slip. So it'd be nice if it led to, I mean, it would actually be really easy to write a Qt application using the Spotify library and make it exactly as functional as the OS X and Windows applications.
This is great. So is this you offering to build one as well now? Well, after Mike's coding challenge.
Right, under the throbber. And then.
I haven't got a premium account and I'm not quite pushed to do it. I mean,
how about as part of a larger Qt designer tutorial series?
How about we get a premium account bought for you on expenses?
Yes.
And then
okay,
you
I'll
can
do
use
it.
That
yeah.
as the basis yeah. of a tutorial series.
Yeah, I'll do that.
You heard it here first. I'll write that one down. Still to come, of course, is our discovery of the week, where we outline one great thing we've found in the last 2 weeks or so. Why is it called discovery of the week if it's the last 2 weeks or so?
Because you only get 1 week to discover it.
And we're not allowed to say fortnight.
That's true. It was originally, this is an outtake, I guess, for the readers who listen to this,
Subscribers only get the outtakes.
We were going to call this discovery of the fortnight, because fortnight means 2 weeks in real English, but we don't think Americans know what fortnight means. So if you know what fortnight means, leave a comment on this blog and tell us, and we'll change to discovery of the fortnight.
Yes.
Stupid Americans. Right. And also, no, we love Americans, we do. We're not afraid of them. Hi, Chad. All right, moving on.
Hi, Cuba.
And still to come, of course, is the open ballot as well. But we're asking, should netbook makers standardise on a single Linux distro?
Right. Gather round, children, for discovery of the week. Graham,
why don't
you start?
Well, I've spent ages looking for a music-related discovery of the week. Because
good
it's
work.
Been a good few weeks since I had one.
And, yeah, that's true.
And it is a utility that I found 8 years ago.
8 years ago?
No.
A year ago.
A few years ago.
Discovery of a few years, all right.
It's called Soft Squeeze, and it's actually a Java application, but we can forgive it for that. But what it does is it connects to your Slim server. Slim server, it's a server running on your music media player that catalogs all your music and provides a web interface and can also stream music to proprietary boxes now made by Logitech.
Okay.
But the Slim server software is open source. You can listen to your music through a web browser as well. And it's great. It grabs albums, playlists. You can subscribe to podcasts. This is all done through Slim server and the web interface. Now, Soft Squeeze is a Java application that connects to your Slim server either through an SSH tunnel or directly if you're on the LAN. And sits just like a normal application on your desktop and works just like the hardware unit sold by Logitech and lets you listen and access your music. It's great.
So you can add effects and stuff, you know, for complete Luddites like me.
It doesn't. There's no effects to it. No, it just means that if you've got a large music collection sitting on a server somewhere, you can access it from a laptop or while you're away from your house or from anywhere on the internet through this application.
Oh, right, like so remote access.
Yeah, it's an interface to your music collection, and it lets you listen to it. So, you know, the Slim server catalogues everything, sorts it by genre or artist or album, and
this little application. How does it perform for a desktop Java app?
It's pretty good. I mean, there's not that much that it's doing, really. I mean, it's just sending instructions to the server and streaming the audio back.
Streaming the music back, right.
But it works great, and if you happen to use Slim server, which I can highly recommend, it's the best way of using it at the moment.
The best way.
Yeah, and it saves you forking out for one of Logitech's expensive boxes.
Too right. We don't like spending money here in Discovery of the Week. My discovery of yesterday is Kana Test, which is a program for practicing learning Japanese characters.
Another one.
Would you believe it? Yeah, well, the other one was a game, but this is just an all-out learning tool. So
this is level two.
Yes, yeah. This is moving on.
Haven't you learned the characters yet?
No.
Japanese is easy,
Mike.
You mentioned about that.
This lets you learn katakana and the hiragana scripts, the syllabaries.
Sorry?
Katakana. Back on topic. What makes this app so special is that you can set up your own lessons, choosing individual characters, the ones that you forget quite a lot, and then create graphs and charts of how much you fail or succeed. So you can get a real good visual indication of what you need to learn, and I love it. So
you can get a 3D pie chart saying fail.
Basically, yeah.
Nice. You fail in a really attractive way.
Reaffirm, yeah. Yeah, what you're doing wrong. So that's mine. Andrew?
Well, as you know, I moved house last week. I found some of my old psychology books from university, and opened it at random on a page about IQ testing and how the results are often skewed because different cultures have different kinds of logic that are all equally valid. And you know, if you're coming from one kind of thought process, you know, it might not come through on a standard Western IQ test. So one of the examples given was they showed some people a picture of a red tomato, a red car, a red shirt and a green tree, and asked them for the odd one out. And the answer in our culture would be the tree, because it's green. But this whatever tribe in Africa they were testing it on kept picking the tomato, and the intelligence testers couldn't work out why these people were so thick that they couldn't work out that it was obviously the green one that was the odd one out. And then when they went back and asked them, these Bushmen said, well, it's the only one you can eat.
It's a different kind of priority what was important.
Yeah, an equally sensible sort of logical structure, but one that was alien to the chaps that they were testing. And I feel that way using Yast.
That was the best lead-in to some Yast criticism ever.
Because I can see that it's all there. I can see the logic. There is a logic, but it's just not my logic.
Yast is, just to remind listeners, the configuration toolkit from OpenSUSE. And SUSE Enterprise 11, carry on.
But I can look at it, I can take a step back, and I know that it does everything. It does everything that I want it to do.
If you step too far back, you can't see anything. It's just a massive noise.
That's obviously rubbish. I need to stand in some sort of middle ground.
With a pair of binoculars. What I thought was interesting about what you just said is, if that test, the original IQ test, was so obvious, how did they come up with the test in the first place? You know, we'll test, you know, a whole population on this completely obvious thing where there's one green thing and four red things, and there's a chance some distant tribe somewhere might pick something else. So.
Well, I don't know. I assume it's like the opening questions in Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? It's got to.
Ah, right. That's what you mean.
Gets the first £1,000.
Or maybe it was just to determine if the participant was colourblind at the start.
There was another excellent one. Racing is to Ascot what boating is to. And then there's a multiple choice. Yeah, and one of the answers is Henley, which is the right answer. And this was included in some IQ tests from the 30s. absolutely amazing. Brilliant. Well done, lads.
I think I did the same course as you, because I did the same thing. And I did a test and got the IQ of a 7-year-old. Because it was
yes,
IQ test.
That's why.
Yeah. I think, the one I did was apparently for married black people in North America. And it was questions like, to get the best flavour, how long should chitlins be left in the oven? And I got lost. I don't remember what chitlins is. You know, what the heck is it? I've got no idea, so I completely failed. Does that leave me then?
It does indeed, finally.
Mine isn't quite so long-winded.
Short and sweet.
It's not even a programme. My discovery of the week is actually quite pathetic, because I'm going to say it, and lots of guys are going to listen to this and say, I've known that for years, you moron, Paul. Well, yes, I'm afraid. I'll just come out with it. What I've discovered is that when you type a command on Linux and you hit enter and it goes, you can't do that, you're not root. What you do is you just type sudo, I guess, if you're saying that way, sudo space exclamation mark, because exclam means last command on bash, and if you put sudo before it, it'll execute it as root. Because what I normally do is I normally type su space dash, I guess if you're on Fedora, enter, and then copy and paste the command or type it again from scratch and hit enter. Which is lame, because sudo xlim actually works better.
So as a guesstimate, how much more productive will you be now that you've learnt this?
I would say at least 5 microscobles.
That's odd.
Yeah.
In this week's Open Ballot, we're asking the question, should netbook manufacturers standardise on one distro? This is not just for the sake of cutting down people's choice of being a distro fascists. We don't want to do that. But we thought it might be nice if people possibly got a united front, a standard that we could all get behind and use as a basis for development. So that would be something along the lines of the Moblin project, which is currently being sponsored by Intel, or Debian, which of course is used as a base for Ubuntu, Crunchbang, several other kinds of Linux distributions. It doesn't necessarily stifle people, but it gives them all a base that they can build on and conquer the world, which is obviously what we want. Mike?
Yes?
A standard distro for netbooks, does that sound like a good idea to you?
Yeah, I think we've got one already. It's called Ubuntu Netbook Remix. I think...
But what about the choice, Mike?
Hang on, does that mean I'm ahead of the curve again?
Yes, yeah. By installing
win.
It.
Made of win.
Look, until Canonical does anything bad or wrong, or why are we bothered about saying, look, they are putting a lot of effort into making a distribution perfect for netbooks, getting the right drives in there, getting the screen space used adequately, used brilliantly, then let's just back behind that. There's nothing to lose.
Well, I guess the argument is that some people might not agree with the way Canonical are doing things, and they don't really have that much say over it. You know, it's a private concern. It's kind of against the open source ethos. If Canonical want to put their own interface to Launchpad in there, then they can. You know,
yeah.
Which we might not necessarily like. I mean, they won't do that for a netbook, but.
I'm not saying it solves all problems, but if we want netbooks with Linux to take off and deal with that potential 96% Windows figure that we were talking about before, then we have to make some sacrifices, like Churchill's whole thing on democracy. It may not be perfect, but it's the best we've got to have a standard distro.
So in the same way that the last episode's question was, should we have a united front, you think that it's better that we have a united front for all the faults and failures of whatever distro we choose?
Oh, definitely. Without a doubt, yeah. I think deal with this for now. Deal with, if this figure from Microsoft has any validity to it, then we have to do something. And we can't give people, because people get a netbook and they go on the internet and say, I want to install this, how do I do that? And you've got it all, what are you running? You're running this Limpus thing, or you're running the X, Y, or Z distro with these updates? No, if you can just say, you've got a netbook with Linux, click A, then B, then C. That would be huge.
I don't think it's ever going to happen. I think each netbook manufacturer is going to want to make their own secret deals, leverage their own kind of software, their own logos, their own kind of...
But then they'll cock it up because somebody will buy one of these netbooks and then think, oh, it's got Linux, go to ubuntuforums.com, and then it just turns into this gigantic mess.
The it's never going to happen theme came a few times. Hugh says, if all manufacturers use the same distro and put their pooled resources into it, it would be great for the consumer. However, how would they then compete? He says some of the things, but ends with, no, I can't see it happening, but yes, I would like it to happen. Also shared by Charlie Ullman from tuxradar.com, it's going to be much more difficult to try to form a consensus between the most pointlessly factional of all human populations, i.e. the Linux geek population. If a Linux distribution were agreed upon, it would have to be a really robust and non-crashable one, probably Debian. Definitely not Ubuntu, Mike.
Ooh.
In your place.
Wrong.
Back to the naughty step.
Why is it wrong? Because we put this question on Twitter, and one of the responses was, the question was, should we standardise on one distro? And one of the responses was, yes, as long as it's Ubuntu. I think that's very, very dangerous, because I can see why Ubuntu Netbook Remix is popular, but I think there are some things it does definitely, definitely wrong. One of which is the Maximus Window Manager. Automatically maximizes everything.
Right.
And the problem is, the way GTK is designed is, it's designed to handle multiple screen resolutions, so things just stretch to fit the screen.
Yeah.
So you've got a small dialogue box, Maximus maximizes it, so the windows are, buttons are 1,000 pixels across, which looks stupid. It's very, very hard to use.
I've seen it, yeah. It looks daft in many cases, but all that needs is some sort of toggle. All it needs some sort of switch. I don't think we should say, well, the current, you know, testing versions of Ubuntu Netbook Remix have this little oddity, when they're actually working on getting drivers in there and getting the boot time down and all of the great netbook features. And we just say, oh, well, we don't want Ubuntu Netbook Remix because of that. Just, you know.
But I'd rather see that be part of Moblin, so that people standardise on Moblin and work out from there.
I think Moblin would be pretty good too, yeah. I'm just thinking along the lines of established current Linux distros that we can all bring up a command line on.
But I know, but Ubuntu Netbook Remix is completely new. It looks nothing like Ubuntu.
Yeah, it has the Ubuntu feel to it.
It's brown.
Yeah, and it's got the circular icons. And...
Circular icons?
Yeah. It feels Ubuntu-ish to me.
It's brown! That's all it is, it's brown!
Yeah, and I bet you can... You've used Moblin on that little... We had a MID device, a demo MID device, and that looked nothing like any Linux whatsoever. That was bizarre.
Yeah, but I think that's because Moblin currently, it's like LSB, it needs to go a lot further.
Yeah.
I think it needs to standardise on many more things to be useful. And when that's the case, I'm perfectly happy for MSI or ASUS or Acer to customise all they want, because when so many things are standardised, they're just changing the icing on the cake.
Yeah, but then you've got the problem as well. Like on that MID device, if you want to tell somebody to open up the Instant Messenger, they could all standardise on Pidgin, but if it's called Instant Messenger on one distro.
Standardize it to the point where people can't break that kind of thing. We need to say, listen, the menus are here.
But then the menus have to be the same, and the icons should be the same.
Yeah, sure, that could be the same. Yeah.
So just use one distro and that's it.
No, I totally agree, the underlying thing should all be the same. If they want to change the colours, if they want to add logos, if they want to add their own custom programs to do more things like MSI Support Connect or something like that, I don't know what it is, something like that, I'm happy for them to do that, as long as the base stuff is all there.
Yes.
And that's almost exactly what Daz Fuller says. I think with netbooks, it makes more sense to stick with a single unified system that manufacturers can modify to suit their needs, i.e. colour schemes, default apps and hardware support. However, he says that he doesn't want to say which distro he thinks it should be for fear that supporters of rival distros might find him and hurt him in ways which he does not want to think about.
I can barely sleep.
And that's
love Python, really.
And that's exactly why I don't want to give any currency to Anonymous Penguin, who says, you guys should have a video podcast. quite happy hiding behind the microphone. Thanks. Julie B.
Take your hat off there.
Julie B says OEMs are going to want to make deals that generate money on each sale. They'll try to get a few bucks from the likes of Yahoo for adding a toolbar to Firefox or something similar. I think each OEM will have its own way. It will probably change a lot until each finds what works for them. They'll make decisions based on customer feedback, and some of which will come from those who are not familiar with Linux. Good points, but I'm not sure whether that's in favour or against standardisation.
One question for one of the previous comments. At what point did Linux become the competition ground for netbooks? The way I see it, if you buy a Windows laptop, they all run Windows, usually Home, Basic or Home Premium, but they all run the same Vista TAT. They're competing on price, features, and design for a lot of the time too, how good things are, how quality they are. I think Linux can be the same. It doesn't have to have a different Linux distro to be better or worse, because consumers are not in a position to be able to judge accurately. That's clearly a better Linux, looking at Linpus Lite with the Spy One. They've got no idea. All they care about is the hardware. Having watched my father buy one a few months ago, he bought a nice Samsung one. He said, you know, how many cells battery life has it got? What kind of hard drive has it got? What kind of screen resolution has it got? They're the basic things he could judge accurately by looking at a bit of paper. The distro he's got, I have no clue.
He presumably knew he could get help if he wanted to install Linux on it.
I don't know, he knows he definitely can't get help. I've told him in the past, no. And without further time wasting, that brings us to the end of our podcast for this week.
Oh, Mike, it's okay.
But it just happens every single podcast. Paul never lets me do my one more thing. I think it's getting a bit serious now.
I know.
Paul, Mike, you know.
I'm just so sorry, Mike.
All right. So with that, my one last thing. Now, Paul, in your discovery of the week, you described using 2 exclamation marks to repeat the last command that you'd entered.
I did, right.
Which is great, but there's more. A single exclamation mark, followed by a series of characters, repeats the last command that started with those characters. So say, for instance, you started an SSH session ages ago. The big long command, big long hostname, port name, stuff like that. You want to go back to it. Instead of scrolling up through your bash history, just enter !SSH and it will run the last SSH command that you entered.
Doesn't that have an element of Google's I'm feeling lucky?
Yeah.
!RM. It's, oh my god, no! Yeah.
It's also a lot of fun for trying out random commands, yeah, like nano and stuff.
But, can you press Control and R for that interactive search?
You can, yeah, I search.
You can, but, you know, the way I use it is just, I SSH into something
a second ago.
You know, and I can't be asked scrolling back, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a very impressive one more thing. Yeah. Well done, nice, Mike. Nice, yes, that's good. And with that, it brings us to the real end of our podcast. I'd like to remind you, of course, about fantastic subscriptions deals in Linux format. It delivers to your door 13 times a year for just $99. Go to tinyurl.com/podcastlxf. As a reminder, all the notes for this podcast are, of course, on the website. You can tune in 2 weeks' time. Actually,
2 weeks' time?
Fortnite. You can tune in a fortnight to hear some more jokery and hopefully get the first results from Mike's throbber code for GTK3 and Graham's Spotify client, the QT designer. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.